This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to continue our political discussions with perhaps one of the best-known politicians in North Dakota, and she's locked in a very tight race for re-election for her Senate seat with Kevin Kramer. Kevin has been on our show. He joined us last month, and Heidi Heitkamp is with us now. And Heidi, welcome to our studio.
Thanks, Doug.
Well, the important first question is always, why are you running for re-election?
Because I've had 6 years to represent the people of the state of North Dakota. We've accomplished an incredible amount. 1.5 farm bills. Hopefully we'll get 2 farm bills done in this first Congress or in this first term. Lifting the 40-year ban on oil exports, doing some work on making sure that we have new technologies that will enhance and improve our opportunity to continue to generate electricity with coal. And when you look at kind of the social issues across the state of North Dakota, the critical issue of what are we going to do to make sure that we have workforce, what are we going to do to make sure we have federal programs that grow our workforce, but then kind of healthcare has been a huge issue in this campaign. You know, we've worked so hard to try and make sure that we keep rural health care vibrant and alive. I think that that's one of the areas that we still need to work. But I think having secured Medicaid expansion and taking a look at several of the policies that we've included in various bills as it relates to our rural hospitals have been critical in keeping those open. You know, the thing I say, Doug, is that coming from a town of 90 people, Manador, North Dakota, we all knew that agriculture was the foundation of the economy. But I think our life experiences inform what our priorities are going to be when you serve in a position like this. And I tell everybody, I wake up every morning and I think about, what are we going to do to enhance the opportunity for rural America, whether that's in agriculture, rural health care, whether it is law enforcement, which is challenged, behavior and mental health, service delivery. And so for me, it's about continuing the work that I've started. It's about continuing to represent the people of North Dakota to accomplish things that will make this state even better for our kids.
All right. I was going to ask you, what are the most important issues? You kind of ticked through a bunch of them, and we'll dive a little more deeply into some of those. But let's talk about the campaign itself for just a moment here, because most voters in the state will have seen a barrage of ads on television, a lot of stuff online. We've heard stuff on the radio. It's basically managed by polls and by, you know, political operatives. When do we get the real campaign with two people talking to each other? Is that ever going to happen again?
Well, we've taken every debate opportunity that we could and said yes, and Congressman Kramer has consistently said no. You know, here's a great example of his refusal to kind of sit across the table and do exactly what you're talking about, Doug. Fox News, not exactly that bastion of liberal, you know, media, asked us if we'd be willing to do a debate on national Fox News, an hour long. We came back that same day and said absolutely, and Congressman Kramer's campaign said no. I think that one of the real challenges that you have is, you know, if the other side won't debate you, it gets awfully tough. We made a big deal out of that at Big Iron. You know, that was supposed to be our opportunity to really have an ag policy debate. Congressman Kramer refused to even go to share the stage with me at Big Iron. So we took the whole hour and talked about what we saw as the challenges and the opportunities in agriculture. So kind of ironic, typically what would happen is the incumbent would be dodging debates, and it's exactly the opposite in this case.
Well, there are two debates coming up. We missed the one you were going to have on Prairie Public last Friday, and that's a shame because I think our listeners would have really appreciated that. But you do have two coming up, one by the North Dakota Newspaper Association, one by the North Dakota Broadcasters Association, that will really be just before the midterm vote. Mm-hmm. So that kind of does leave it out there.
I think one of the things, though, I will tell you, and maybe you're overly optimistic, Doug, I'm not convinced a lot of people make up their mind anymore in debates. I think debates become kind of In some ways, people who have already made up their mind watch to make sure that their team performs well.
Well, you could say the same thing about what's on television and on the radio.
I think that's right.
I mean, who's left to convince?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of argument about that. But I will tell you what we believe is possible is going door to door, talking to voters at the door, talking to voters on the telephone, listening to their concerns, responding to their concerns. We have a very strong record of meeting with North Dakotans when they come to D.C. and meeting with North Dakotans when we're home, advancing issues. And so I think if people are open-minded and they aren't just going to vote for one political party or the other, they're persuadables, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, you mentioned the farm bill and health care. Those are big issues in North Dakota. And
tariffs.
Yes, lots of places. We'll get into tariffs as well. But you made a decision last weekend. It got in the way of that debate mm-hmm. we were talking about here at Prairie Public to vote against the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court. Can you describe the process you went through on that decision?
Well, it's interesting. Let's start out with my presumption. My presumption is that the nominee of the president is entitled to deference and entitled to confirmation barring a disqualifying event. And so I met with and that's the standard I applied when I reviewed Neil Gorsuch's nomination, who I actually voted to confirm. One of three Democrats that did. And so I definitely believe that elections have consequences. The president ran saying these were the judges I was considering. People voted him in. I think that he's entitled to his nominee, barring a disqualifying event. So really leading up to after the visit and after the initial hearing, we were preparing to announce that we were going to be a yes. And then the intervening event with the letter with Dr. Ford's testimony and Brett Kavanaugh's response. And so I will say two things about that. I believe Dr. Ford. I have a great deal of experience working with victims, what happens after a traumatic event. It doesn't mean I disbelieve him when he says he doesn't recall this. He said he didn't do it, but I think it's possible that he does not recall that this happened. But more importantly is his reaction. You know, this is probably the first time that this gentleman's ever been under any kind of scrutiny or pressure. And I think that what he demonstrated to me was the lack of judicial temperament, the lack of impartiality. And honestly, the interaction that he had in answering questions and some of the responses led me to believe, as a lot of fact checkers have looked at, that in fact many of those answers were not as truthful as they could have been. But it was the moment at which he had a response with Senator Klobuchar, which I thought was the kind of pivotal moment for me where I looked at it and thought, this is not what you want in a Supreme Court justice.
That's where he asked her if she'd ever been blackout drunk.
Yeah,
or
right,
she
twice.
Asked him first.
Yeah,
and,
twice he and, asked. Yeah. Have you? And to me, one of the issues that we have to kind of confront is that we now live in a hyper-partisan world. Mm-hmm. So we have an incredibly partisan administration. We have a partisan Congress. Now we're transplanting that to the third branch of government, and it really is undermining institutional appreciation of the institutions that we have. And so I really – Lisa Murkowski, when she made her comments, definitely – said it best of anyone and best reflects kind of my perspective and my point of view. So it wasn't about, just believing Dr. Ford. It was about judicial temperament. And I think lawyers maybe looked at that and saw behaviors that would question whether that person should be on the most important court in the land.
I think people, though, were surprised to hear you talk about your mother's experience in relation to this issue.
Yeah, well, that kind of happened by accident, actually. I haven't talked about it in the past because it's my mother's story. And most people know my mother has since passed on. But when Congressman Cramer talked about how his mother wasn't going to be victimized by this kind of discussion because she's a strong woman of the prairie and his wife is a strong woman of the prairie and his daughters are strong women of the prairie, kind of went for me that is the implication then people who have been victims, that they're not strong, that they've been victimized because they're not strong, or they should just shut up about it and that makes them strong. And I mean, and I just want to say kind of defending my mom and saying, you know, my mom was strong and she was a victim of sexual assault and it made me and my four sisters a lot stronger. And she taught us to stick up for ourselves and stick up for victims and stick up for people. And so it was kind of that moment that I had no intention of ever talking about it, but it was in response to kind of a level of arrogance about this is my family and we're so much stronger than anyone who's ever been victimized by sexual assault.
You talked about this as a partisan battle, the Supreme Court nomination and the ultimate vote. Has the Supreme Court lost some of its, core, its essence because of this?
I don't know. I think, you know, Justice Gorsuch, now on the court, very, very conservative judge, nominated by, you know, President Trump. I tell people I not only supported him, I advocated for him because I thought even though he's conservative, he had the right temperament. He had the right kind of, you know, there was moments when he pushed back against the president saying that talking about bringing partisanship to the court. And people kind of forget that during his confirmation hearing. I thought that takes courage, you know, to push back against the president who nominated you. We certainly did not see that with Justice now Justice Kavanaugh, and so I think that what people need to think about is the comparison, and I think that the court is going to have a tilt or a bent that's going to go back and forth with whoever is in the nominating process, but to bring a belief system that you know you're wrong because you're on one side of the political aisle or not, I've been saying. Lady Justice is blind for a purpose, and this is an institution that has to be above politics and above partisanship. And I think where Neil Gorsuch passed that test, in fact, in my opinion, with flying colors, Judge Kavanaugh did not.
Donald Trump was about as atypical a candidate as I could have imagined in North Dakota in 2016. A developer lives in New York City and probably didn't know much about this part of the country. But he won North Dakota very easily. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he did? And what sort of influence do you think he'll have on the upcoming midterm election?
Well, I think certainly Congressman Cramer has made this election about the president. And so – to be successful, I think he thinks he needs to nationalize the race. And, yeah, you know, it's my job to talk about what I want to do and give people a choice between someone who would vote with the president 100% of the time and somebody who would review every issue and try and work across the partisan divide to get results and accomplish things for North Dakota. And, you know, so I didn't go there to join a political team. I went there to represent the people. I went there to have a discussion about how we can change the political dynamic in this country. I think Congressman Cramer has made it clear that he's going there to support the president 100% of the time.
I think there was a fair amount of surprise in farm country that the president imposed these tariffs against China a couple months ago now, and that now the soybean growers are severely impacted. Let's talk about the effect of the trade war, the growing trade war, on North Dakota.
This is an area people always say, well, where do you agree with the president? Where do you disagree? This is an area where I vehemently disagree with the president. You know, I don't just talk about the Chinese tariffs. I start with pulling out of TPP. TPP had some great things in it.
The Trans-Pacific
Partnership. I think the better course if the president didn't like the agreement was to sit down and renegotiate those pieces he didn't like. And I think that our ally countries who were part of TPP would have been willing to do that. And so instead, We unilaterally pulled out. Our trading partners went forward with TPP without the United States of America. What does that mean? It means that we had a chance to unite with our allies to provide a trading bloc to compete in a very strong way, compete against China. So we now have ceded any influence that we might have in a trade pact in the Pacific. And that's going to have long-term ramifications. And people say, well, we're in discussions with Japan. Guess what? Japan says we'll do a bilateral. Guess what Japan took off the table? Anything dealing with agriculture. So where TPP opened up some of the Japanese markets for our ag commodities and our ag products, that's now off the table. So TPP was in my opinion, kind of the beginning of a trade disruption. Then we went to renegotiation of NAFTA, which we've just, you know, we'll see what happens with the vote. You know, when you look at this, people say, well, what are the wins for North Dakota in this renegotiated NAFTA? What I would say is we have more access on dairy. Dairy's not a big industry for North Dakota, but for those who actually produce dairy products, it's helpful. But grain grading. We have a grain grading problem, which means that our grain, when it goes to Canada, is automatically categorized as feed grain. It's not appropriately graded so that we can get higher value. Guess what? Congressman Kramer, with his comments, almost derailed that portion of the NAFTA renegotiation. And so we were able to pull that back, reaching out to both Mexico and Canada, encouraging them to reach a deal. But anyone who thinks that there's going to be a big explosion for agriculture as a result of the renegotiation of NAFTA is wrong. That we didn't gain a whole lot. And so now let's go on to the steel and aluminum tariffs. North Dakota is the ninth most dependent on importation of steel in the country of any state. We have a large oil and gas industry. We have a large ag equipment manufacturers. All of these organizations that are small ag manufacturers are being severely impacted. We didn't get in the renegotiation of NAFTA. The president did not lift the steel tariffs on Canada. So we're still in that retaliatory situation with both Mexico and Canada. Now let's talk about China. Everybody agrees China cheats, and we need to do everything we can. I'm telling you, TPP was a great step in improving our trade relationships with China. But if you look at where the most egregious behavior is, it's in technology, it is in licensing, and there's a telecommunications company called ZTE. It's a very large telecommunications company in China. They are not only cheaters in tariffs and intellectual property, they also are a national security threat. And as a result, the Department of Commerce had sanctioned them. The president lifted sanctions on ZTE when we could have leveraged those to get soybeans into the market. And so right now we're at 100 days where we've had zero orders for soybeans out of the Pacific Northwest, and that is having a huge impact. Number one, we've got our bankers telling us we're in a black swan event, and we've got our ag producers telling us they're out of storage for soybeans, and we have miserable weather for harvest.
Yeah.
And so this very we were fragile in the farm economy going into this, and putting this kind of additional stress on the farm economy. I mean, I'm just not going to stand back. You know, and if I could just say this, Congressman Kramer says, well, I don't like tariffs either, but we have to support the president. I said, well, you know, that's the kind of Washington double talk. You know, I don't like tariffs, but if the president, uses them, I guess they're okay. Tariffs are taxes. And taxes, anything that makes a long-term decision for our producers, where we lose markets, especially a market as big as China, is a bad deal for us.
Well, let's talk about another big issue for lots of voters, and that's health care. Mm-hmm. You touched on it. And, of course, Congressman Kramer took some heat when the Republicans were going through the repeal of the Affordable Care Act machinations mm-hmm. in Congress. I think there were 60 attempts to repeal it, and that failed. But they're still chipping away at it, and health care is a major financial burden for lots of people these days. So
still is,
where are you on this?
Well, I think let's talk about when people 6 years ago said, where are you at with the Affordable Care Act? I said, I'll talk about the Affordable Care Act, but can we talk about health care? because we just – I mean, we have so closely equated the Affordable Care Act with health care challenges. You know, that doesn't address our high prescription drug costs. That doesn't address demographics, doesn't address research, doesn't address some of the challenges that we have in rural health. And so when I talk about health care, I talk about all of it. But let's compare records. When I was elected, I went to work right away. I formed an advisory committee on healthcare. They're wonderful people. That group has grown like you can't believe. People giving me input all the time. And we said, what are the most important things? And we aligned and tried to work through changes to the Affordable Care Act that would make a difference for North Dakota. Congressman Kramer voted 60 times to undermine it, 5 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act without a replacement. And when someone said, well, what do you mean without a replacement? He said, well, those were largely symbolic votes. Why don't take symbolic health care votes? It's too important. When the time came to take the vote on the repeal and replacement, Congressman Kramer supported a bill that not one patient group, not one health care group, not one constituency group in North Dakota supported. Not one. And it would have eliminated the patient protections of pre-existing conditions. It would have eliminated the patient protections of lifetime caps. It would have repealed Medicaid expansion, which is so important to our rural hospitals and people suffering from opioid addiction. I made a choice to not support that bill. I'm proud of that choice. I think it would have been extraordinarily bad for rural health care across the country, but particularly in North Dakota. The punchline is what happened right after that vote. Congressman Kramer did nothing to address health care challenges. I introduced a bipartisan bill, one of the original sponsors, to try and fix the exchanges so that we could have a discussion about health care. You know, his record is one of politicizing health care. My record is one of trying to solve the problem.
Well, this brings up the final question, I guess, which is, are we doomed to political cycles where one party tries to undo what the previous majority party has done?
Yeah, and that's an excellent question. Been telling people, you know, when you look at political ideology when I first started, and that would be back kind of when you first started, a little grayer now, it was like a bow tie. You know, you had a big knot of moderates in the middle fanning out to probably ideology. Now what it is hardcore right, hardcore left, with a thin line in between, like a dumbbell. And all of us who stand in the middle, who try and bridge those two gaps, those are the folks that tend to have the greatest challenge getting reelected. And so as we look at what we need to do, if you continue to just simply make decisions based on ideology, you don't have permanency. And my record really is one of trying to connect the two sides. And here's the best example I can give you of why we can get this done. And it's our coal technology bill. You know, Sheldon Whitehouse, deeply concerned about climate. He's from Rhode Island. I think they have elevation changes of about a foot. So, of course, he's concerned about rising sea level. If you look at Mitch McConnell, I mean, clearly concerned about the coal industry. They co-sponsored a bill with me to bridge that gap. And I think that's what we need is people who don't go to represent sides. People go to solve problems and give permanency.
Senator Heidi Heitkamp, the incumbent candidate for U.S. Senate, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, voting obstacles on the Standing Rock Reservation. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The 2019 North Dakota legislature will likely be asked to ease some of the regulations on physician assistants.
And a PA is a medical professional, and we diagnose illness, develop and manage treatment plans, prescribe medications, and often serve as a patient's health care provider. PAs work on health care teams with physicians and other providers in every medical setting and specialty.
Jonathan Sobel is the president and board chairman of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. He says North Dakota has about 400 physician assistants.
PAs are educated at the master's degree level, and admission is highly competitive. It requires a bachelor's degree and completion of courses in basic and behavioral sciences as prerequisites to PA school. And incoming PA students bring with them an average of more than 3,000 hours of direct patient contact experience, having worked in fields as paramedics, athletic trainers, medical assistants, for example.
Sobel says in North Dakota, state laws need to change to have the PAs more fully contribute to the medical practice.
In 2019, the North Dakota Academy of PAs will be advocating for legislation to modernize laws affecting how PAs practice in North Dakota. PAs are critical members of patient care teams, and these modernizations, they're vital to ensuring that they can do their part to expand health care access for North Dakotans.
Sobel says this becomes critical in rural areas where there are doctor shortages.
All the studies that have been done throughout the 50 years of the PA profession show that PAs are not only safe practitioners but deliver high-quality care. So certainly looking to change that requirement to have this agreement with a specific physician in order to practice.
Sobel says the profession has been ranked third in the U.S. News & World Report list of best jobs. And the 2019 legislature will likely consider creating a skilled workforce scholarship program. It will be similar to the Build Dakota program created in South Dakota. A bill draft presented to the legislature's interim taxation committee would create a scholarship fund of $20 million, half of which would be provided by the state-owned Bank of North Dakota and the other half by private industry. That money would create an endowment fund. It would provide full-ride scholarships to students who enter study related to critical need careers, and the scholarships would be aimed at two-year programs. Any students who take advantage of the program would have to agree to stay in North Dakota for a period of time. The Economic Development Association of North Dakota is pushing the idea. Ellen Huber is the association's president.
The shortage of workforce in North Dakota is one of our biggest limitations to further expanding our economy and capitalizing opportunities that we have before us. And so this is really nationwide shortage of workforce, not unique to North Dakota. And we recognize that we're competing for talent with every state in the nation.
Huber says studies have shown in other states that the majority of students who enroll in these kinds of programs stay in state after graduation. She says this will provide opportunity for students who can't afford to go to college without incurring student loan debt. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and I want to extend a very heartfelt thank you to all the people who contributed. We just finished our fall membership on-air drive, and whether you responded to the pleas in the mail or on the phone beforehand or on the air during the drive, we really appreciate your support. It's our most important support, and we couldn't do this service without our members. Now, if you didn't get a chance to give during the drive, well, we're not going to turn you away, and we'll keep the thank you gifts. We had some fun ones on tap for a little while longer, and you can call 800-359-4145, or you can go to prairiepublic.org, and we can thank you, too.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Carrie Levine. She is with the Center for Public Integrity, and she joins us from her office in Washington, D.C. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And, of course, we're going to talk about your new report, What Stands in the Way of Native American Voters. It's posted online at prairiepublic.org, and I encourage people to go up and read this report. It's not a radio report. It's not a television link. It's an actual physical printed report by Carrie Levine, the producer of this story. Carrie, a little background here. What is the Center for Public Integrity?
Thanks for asking. We're a nonprofit investigative newsroom in Washington, D.C. that concentrates on doing long-form work and sharing it with other news media outlets like Prairie.
What's your position with the Center for Public Integrity?
I'm a senior reporter on our federal money and politics team.
Okay. And why did you produce this report? Again, it's titled, What Stands in the Way of Native American Voters?
Well, it's actually part of a larger project that we're doing this year on the federal politics team called Abandoned in America. We're profiling six communities around the country that, you know, have not really been benefiting from the booming economy. And Standing Rock is one of those. The president has declared the U.S. economy to be the best economy we've ever had in the history of our country, and his administration has declared the war on poverty largely over. So we wanted to visit communities where residents say that really doesn't apply to them, and they're still wrestling with the problems associated with poverty and the question of what clout they have going into this critical midterm election.
Well, you mentioned this larger project, Abandoned in America, with six communities sort of highlighted. So how did the Standing Rock Reservation become one of those communities?
Well, we went through a lengthy process to figure out where to go. And there are really a lot of places that we could have gone. We started just like we always start. We started with data. And we analyzed a lot of data sets that touch on economic vitality, political power. We looked at campaign contribution data from the Federal Election Commission. We looked at voter turnout data in the different states and counties and communities. Census Bureau data on household income, race, ethnicity. We looked at congressional district office locations and where members of Congress hold town halls. And then we narrowed it down to a few dozen communities and researched them further before ultimately deciding where to go.
And the Standing Rock Reservation and other reservation areas in North Dakota have had usually over the course of time lower than expected voter turnouts, I take it.
Right. And so when we looked at the voter data from North Dakota, we looked at the data from the past five elections and averaged over those five elections, Sioux County, which is the North Dakota part of the Standing Rock Reservation, had the lowest turnout in the state. And we thought that was just an interesting thing to follow up on. And I think it's worth noting, too, that two other counties whose populations are majority Native American have the second and third lowest turnout in the state over that same period of five elections.
So how did you approach the question your report poses? What stands in the way of Native American voters? What is standing in the way?
Well, the answer is I did what reporters do, which is I went and I asked. And I said to people, Standing Rock outside of North Dakota is very associated with the political protests that took place here with the protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, seems to represent a certain level of political engagement, at least from the outside looking in. And so I think one question I had was, why isn't the voting turnout higher? And the answers that I got were really complicated. People said, well, we don't trust the government. And just like in many poor communities, they said, we don't think our vote will make a difference. We don't always think our vote matters. There was a sense of disenfranchisement. And what people brought up to me also over and over again were first the pressures of poverty, that people had so many things to worry about. They were worried about putting food on the table. They didn't have transportation, and getting to the polls was a burden. They didn't have the resources to think about it. And the other thing that people broke up was really the long history our nation has with Native Americans, with tribes, of not keeping promises, of not upholding treaties, things that are still, I think, very fresh in people's minds and very important.
Is the Standing Rock Reservation unique across the country in terms of Native American tribal organizations? Are there energized reservations when it comes to voting?
That's a great question. I can't say that I've looked at every single reservation that's out there and can answer that question completely. I do think that there are some unique things about the Standing Rock Reservation, but I actually think that this is a larger problem. I went to a roundtable as part of my reporting held by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee in Washington, and one thing that people talked about were barriers to the voting box, to the ballot box for tribes all over the country. That there are voter ID rules that play out, that there are rural communities, reservations, where getting to the polls is a real issue, that there are language barriers for people, that there are cultural barriers. And so that is something that was really the subject of a lot of discussion in Washington.
So what are the barriers that you revealed in your report about that take place on Standing Rock?
Well, one is transportation. People don't always have cars. Distances are vast. And so there are multiple places to vote on the reservation, but they're not all open for the same hours. Some hours are shorter than others, and not everyone can get to the polls. And I think identification is an ongoing issue, and I think we're going to see with the new ruling, with the new voter identification requirements in place for the November election, how many people are able to comply with them. That's going to play out in this election. And I think, too, you're really going to see whether people are motivated to turn out, whether they feel that they have faith in the government and in their participation in the government and have faith for that to matter. It's sort of an interesting juxtaposition. at 538.com, which is a site that analyzes data, recently calculated that a North Dakota voter really has more power to determine the partisan majority in the Senate after this election than a voter anywhere else in the country. It was something like 30 times the power of the average American voter to discover, to determine the partisan fate of the Senate.
Is that a reflection of our population?
I think some of it is math, yes. There are just fewer voters in North Dakota, but you also have a very critical Senate race. And so in some ways right now, a North Dakota voter is a very powerful person. But what I heard over and over again was that there was a real sense of powerlessness, mm-hmm. that people didn't feel that their vote was going to matter that much. And so I think you sort of have that interesting juxtaposition.
Well, 6 years ago, Heidi Heitkamp, the Democratic NPL candidate for Senate, U.S. Senate, won a close election. And a lot of the credit for that went to support from Native Americans. And in your report, What Stands in the Way of Native American Voters, this is Carrie Levine with the Center for Public Integrity. In your report, you point out that the legislature changed the law a bit after Heidi Heitkamp's victory. And what conclusion or what did you make of that change?
So that's fascinating. North Dakota, as you pointed out, is a state where there is only so many voters. The number of voters is typically, depending on whether it's a midterm or a presidential, at least the last few elections, somewhere in the 250,000 to 350,000 voter range. And for a long time, North Dakota was a really easy state in which to vote. It required ID, but if you didn't have it, poll workers who knew the voter were permitted to vouch for them. Voters could sign an affidavit saying they had the right to vote. So when Senator Heitkamp won in 2012, as you point out, it was a very close election. She won by fewer than 3,000 votes. And the legislature, in the wake of that, changed the law. And so they put in more strict requirements for identification, and they're requiring that identification have a residential street address, not a P.O. box. So a lot of people have said that the motivation for that really is that Heitkamp won by so few votes, and the requirement that there be a residential street address is something that can fall heavily on reservations where many people use P.O. boxes. Many people didn't necessarily have a residential street address. And so the state says it's been moving to get everyone assigned a residential street address. It has a process to go through if you want one. But what the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Mike Faith, said to me was that he really does think this was done in the wake of Heitkamp's victory, done for partisan reasons because of that.
Do reservation leaders help and encourage tribal members to vote?
Yes, they are. And Mike Faith talked a little bit about that, and the tribe is moving now, I heard, to help people get new ID, to help people in that process if they need a residential street address, and they're going to be offering some transportation for the polls, and the efforts differ from tribe to tribe. So I think that's something that tribes are moving to do, especially in the wake of the decision this week.
You mentioned the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, which put Standing Rock on the map internationally, actually. There was some disappointment from the tribal members about Heidi Heitkamp during that and after that. And did you get any sense of how people might be excited or not excited about voting at Standing Rock this time around?
You know, it's interesting. I was there. I talked to a bunch of people starting in June and July and have been talking to them since then. And certainly people have voiced disappointment that Senator Heitkamp didn't come out strongly against the pipeline. And people talked about that. But I also had a lot of people say to me that they appreciated her efforts in other areas, that even if they didn't agree with her stance on that or wished she had spoken out differently, they still didn't voice any support for her opponent. So a lot of them pointed to things she has done in other areas and work she has done on issues such as the welfare of Native children, legislation to improve how law enforcement keeps track of missing and murdered Indigenous women, her work on housing issues. And so very often what people would say is, yes, I was disappointed in that, but. And so you know, what people will do in the end, I don't know. But certainly there seemed to be a sense that she had worked on other things. And the other thing that people said to me was that she was familiar. She is someone who comes to the reservation. And people pointed to that as important to them, that she took the time to come out even to towns where there were maybe not a lot of people. So the relationship seemed to be a familiar one.
Carrie Levine is with the Center for Public Integrity. She produced a new report, What Stands in the Way of Native American Voters. And Prairie Public is partnering with the Center for Public Integrity to publish this investigation. You can find it online at our website. That's prairiepublic.org. And there are three rotating images on that website homepage. There is one that includes What Stands in the Way of Native American Voters, or just search for that on the website. Carrie Levine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, we go to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org. And by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And I think, Matt, when you go to a movie that's titled Venom, you probably know what to expect, huh?
Yeah, so this is based on the Marvel comic character Venom. I want to let people know this film is a Sony film. So it's sort of part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and sort of not. It's complicated. We're not going to get into that. But it does have a different feel to it than some of the what I would call, the normal Marvel films like Captain America and Iron Man and Thor and the Avengers films.
This guy removes heads, I think.
Yes, he does. So it's based on Eddie Brock. Eddie Brock is played by Tom Hardy, and he's an investigative reporter. I want to use that term very loosely in quotes, because when you watch the film, you're kind of like, does this guy know what he's doing? He sort of schleps around, and you're just kind of wondering with some of the interviews he does if he really knows what he's doing or that kind of thing. So that didn't come off terribly real. But again, it's a comic book film, so we have to get through that. But Hardy plays Eddie Brock, whose girlfriend is played by Michelle Williams, four-time Oscar nominee. And he stumbles on to an interview with a guy named Carlton Drake, who is played by Riz Ahmed, and he is sort of the nefarious villain of the film. He's kind of an Elon Musk type. He wants to go into outer space, but really his real goal is to harvest aliens and use bodies as hosts. And he uses people off the street to test on them, use them as unwitting subjects. And so
these are like parasites.
Yes,
you mean?
Parasite is used a lot. That word is used a lot in this film. So, as you know from the comics, eventually Eddie Brock is infected, and then all heck breaks loose from there. This is a very strange film, Doug. It made $80 million over the weekend, but as I said, it doesn't quite have that something going for it that other Marvel films have. And I think it's kind of a bland cinematography that I didn't care for. And also you're wondering, is Venom a hero or what is he? Is it a comedy? Is it a romance? Is it a drama? What is this film? What we've talked about many times on this show, Doug, does a film know what it wants to be? And I think Lost in a – it's a very short film for a Marvel film too. It's under 2 hours long. And I have read that there were much, much extra things shot and cut out later to make it a PG-13 film. So I don't – it didn't quite go full Deadpool rated R. And it scaled back from that to make it a PG-13. And I think on the editing room floor lies a very different film than we ended up with. I didn't care for it. I know a lot of the fanboys and the Marvel people have liked it. It made a lot of money. I think Tom Hardy's performance is a little erratic. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's very jittery and erratic, and you don't get that sense of him commanding this performance the way Robert Downey did when he first landed in Iron Man.
Well, the intriguing thing to me here is that this anti-hero, this Venom, looks a lot like the alien in Alien. I mean, it really looks terrible, looks very, very frightening. And then what he does is, of course, pretty awful.
So what I read, Doug, was that the R-rated version, if they had gone full bore, was even more violent than what you're going to get on screen. So again, because of the awful things Venom does, you're kind of left with, you know, is Tom Hardy's Eddie Brock a hero? Is he a villain? What is he? And only really at the end of the film do we sort of kind of get this clever Marvel thing going on, which I was kind of waiting for the whole time. Michelle Williams, not sure why she did this film. She's a four-time Oscar nominee. It's one of these thankless roles, again, that oftentimes actresses get put into, the girlfriend role, the wife role, et cetera, et cetera. It's definitely not her film. It's definitely Tom Hardy's film. The villain is good. Jenny Slate shows up in this film, who's a very good actress, a very good comic actress, as one of the doctors at the big lair that the villain has. And she realizes things are not good and she wants to fix things and contacts Eddie Brock to try to get an exclusive and tell him what really is going on behind closed doors. So I don't think it's a very successful film. But again, the box office takes suggest, Doug, that Marvel or any spinoff from Marvel to Sony really can't miss at this point. And I do expect a sequel.
Well, I'm always intrigued by these Marvel movies because they seem to be like morality plays. Mm-hmm. It's good conquers evil, that kind of thing. So do these movies have something to say about the world we live in?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the comics kind of did, if you look back at the comics. But I'm not sure. There's always a villain. There's always a hero. As I said, I think the problem here is we're not sure what Eddie Brock is because he sort of doesn't seem smart enough to be an investigative reporter in the performance he gives. And, you're just kind of left wondering, who is this guy?
Well,
and
let me be very crass. Is he always killing the right people?
Yes and no. I'm not gonna give that away. You're gonna have to go see it. But it is, obviously based on the comics, this is a very violent comic. But I'm not sure Marvel is saying a lot about the world. I mean, sometimes there is. I think Avengers: Infinity War, I think, has some interesting subplots going on about humanity and are there too many people on Earth and that kind of thing. But I didn't care for Venom. My son liked it. His friend liked it. So I'm in the minority there. But it is getting trashed by the critics, and it is not in the top flight of canon of Marvel films, that's for sure. But again, with an $80 million opening weekend in October, they released it at just the right time, Doug, to kind of capture, kind of a blank spot, even though A Star Is Born made $40 million, which was very good, and I'll review that next week.
Well, I kind of wait for the sequel, The Venom 2 or whatever. Maybe Sigourney Weaver will make a cameo appearance in that because, like I said, he looks like Alien to me.
I can tell you that they do set up the next film with a new villain played by a very famous actor, so look for that.
All right. Okay, well, here's a little bit of Oscar trivia, and it's not related to this movie. It's just out of clear blue sky here. But it's an intriguing question for our listeners and for you, I hope. Which film won the most Oscars without winning Best Picture? And I've got four options here for you. You might already know, but The Ten Commandments, Mary Poppins, Raging Bull, or Cabaret?
Cabaret.
Well, that took a long time, didn't it? Yeah. And more information you have to offer?
1972, Cabaret. It won, I think, 8 Oscars that night, Doug, but lost Best Picture to The Godfather.
That is correct. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 12th. Maps can be extremely valuable. They can help you find your way to a location. They can show you the exciting features of a landscape or city. And they can help you visualize the data in different ways. But what about unexplored and unmapped areas? This was the challenge faced by Meriwether Lewis and William Clark in 1804 when President Thomas Jefferson gave them the job of exploring the Louisiana Purchase. In the 1770s and 80s, before the Louisiana Purchase, the Arikara people had settled into three villages at the northern edge of their traditional territory. The population of the tribe had declined dramatically due to smallpox epidemics. The arrival of the Lewis and Clark expedition represented a diplomatic opportunity, reconciliation with their Mandan neighbors, and a trading relationship with their new great father in Washington. While many people have heard of Sacagawea, who helped guide Lewis and Clark, few would recognize the names of other Native Americans who aided the expedition. One such native was Arikara leader Tuné. It was on this date in 1804 that he joined Lewis and Clark on an expedition to a Mandan village on the Knife River. The aim of the trip was to negotiate a temporary treaty between the Arikaras and Mandans. Lewis and Clark would later convince Tuné to make the journey to Washington, D.C., to meet the Great Father, Thomas Jefferson. Unfortunately, he died there in April of 1806, but he left behind an important document, having mapped the Arikara territory for Jefferson. It provided an important base for Clark's later master map of the American West. Tuné's map was rediscovered in a French archive after 200 years in storage. Christopher Jenkins, historian and editor of We Proceeded On, the journal of the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation, said, "Monumental doesn't fully cover the importance of this discovery. This map deepens our understanding of how dependent Lewis and Clark were on the Native American geographers." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jacob Clausen. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's one small step for man.
Neil Armstrong's mission to the moon made him a legend.
I think he's become, in the collective imagination, such a poker-faced, almost marble statue hero. To people like his kids, he was just dad, you know. To people in the neighborhood, he was, you know, he was the guy down the street.
Director Damien Chazelle tells Armstrong's story to a new generation in the film First Man, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll hear from Jeannie Brandt, one of four people seeking one of two open seats on the Public Service Commission. And World War I observances will take place across the state next month on the 100th anniversary of the war's end. That's November 11th. One of the organizers, Daryl Dorgan, will join us to talk about North Dakota's role in that war. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. And we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.